Welcome to Tour Guide Confidential. My name is Dr. Eyal Duchovny, and I am your host here for this backstage tour of the tourism and travel industry. This week we have a very special guest. Her name is Rotem Shachar, and I'll be telling you about her in a couple of minutes. This is actually my longest interview to date, so I kind of pulled a Joe Rogan here. For those who aren't familiar with his three-hour shows, this one isn't that long, but it's still the longest one that I have, so I'm going to try to keep my intro words as brief as possible. That said, there is kind of a lot of ground to cover since the last episode. My last episode, if you recall, I interviewed Daniel Sigalov, and we talked about many things, but in particular, we discussed the whole issue surrounding licenses and whether there should be licenses or not, and a whole kind of free market approach. And as I suspected, there was kind of a lot of pushback. A lot of guides who heard about the episode, even without actually listening to it, felt the need to opine and to mention that such a episode existed and that it was unbelievable that even we would be willing to raise this issue. And I got messages from people telling me that we shouldn't even be discussing these kinds of things. And so I wanted to make it very clear that from my perspective, even if I don't agree with somebody, and if you listen to the episode, I think you heard that I gave Daniel a lot of pushback. I wanted to hear his opinion. I think he had some valid points. I wasn't convinced that there's no need for a license, but I do think that it is illiberal and, frankly, a little bit totalitarian to say that we can't even discuss the matter. And that was what some people were writing and saying. And so, I reject that. This is called Tour Guide Confidential. The goal here is to have free, frank, open discussions. And I think that I achieved that with Daniel's. And I'm here to listen to people's opinions. I'm just not willing to accept when someone tells me that I'm not allowed to even discuss these opinions, because that's where I think people cross a line. Second thing I wanted to say was that in my last episode, I mentioned that I was kind of grappling with this dilemma about whether I should be doing this course that's being offered at the present in order to get a teaching certificate, or whether I should go into this photo and video editing course. And I decided in the end that my heart wasn't with the teaching course. It wasn't something that I really wanted to do. And so I did sign up for the photo and editing course. And I started it today and I had a really good time. So it was very basic, but it reminded me of a lot of things that I'd learned and kind of forgotten about photography. We looked at photos, we had discussions today. It was not a practical class today, but there's still 22 more sessions and we're planning to do photos and editing. And so I'm really looking forward to it and I'll keep you guys posted on that. And then lastly, I wanted to say that this was really a typical week. Maybe I should say a typical 10 days in Israel. Part of my job as a tour guide, I see as being a cultural broker, trying to kind of broker between two different cultures, like, American or European and Israeli, and trying to get people to understand kind of the mindset here. One of the things that you need to understand if you ever come to Israel or spend time in Israel is that, 1 week of news in Israel is like 1 month of news in, places like the Netherlands or Norway, where there's news, but it's not as dramatic as here. I'll give you an example. Today, Israel signed peace or normalization agreements with two Arab countries, United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. In both cases, this is amazing. I mean, Israel hasn't signed any agreements with Arab countries in the last 26 years. And since 2002, when the Saudi peace plan was presented, it was kind of a package deal. You make peace with the Palestinians, then you get peace with the entire Arab world. And since then, nothing has changed. And I think finally, some of the Arab countries kind of came to the realization that true madness is trying to do the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. I hope that this will lead to a broader peace with more Arab countries and also with our neighbors, the Palestinians, because we need to learn to live together, and we're not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere. And so I hope this will actually, you know, push towards peace. And I'm still working on getting us someone from the Palestinian side. I spoke to someone this week who's interested, is going to do some thinking about whether they want to participate or not. I really hope that they do. And I'll keep you posted on that, because there's some excellent guides, of course, in the Palestinian territories and the PNA, the Palestinian National Authority. And I would love to hear what they have to say and what they want to share with us. But like I said, Israel every week, lots of news. So that was huge. In a couple of days, we've got our New Year's, Rosh Hashanah. But in addition to that, we've also got, starting Friday, a second lockdown. Apparently, we're the only country that's going into a second lockdown that's doing this, though the disease, the virus, has been spreading in Europe. And I know that other countries are also grappling with higher numbers than they've seen since the first wave of the disease in the spring. So starting this Friday, we're going into lockdown for 3 weeks. And that's just the kind of initial lockdown phase. People won't be able to go further than 500 meters from their house. There's not going to be any intercity travel between two cities. And on the holidays, it's going to be different than usual, because we won't be able to go to the synagogues to pray like we usually do. So it's pretty dramatic and kind of frankly depressing, because I was hoping, honestly, that by October we'd see, you know, a reduction in the number of cases and maybe the first glimmers of tourism. I have a couple groups that I'm expecting in December, and now it looks increasingly unlikely that they're going to make it here. And so it was a little bit kind of heavy and depressing in that sense. All right, well, this episode is not heavy or depressing, and that's thanks to Rotem, who is really such a genuine, warm, open, and honest person. And I hope, you know, I'm sure you'll see it, hear it in this interview, where we discuss, you know, we cover a lot of ground. We talk about all kinds of things, including questions surrounding gender and whether she thought that guiding is kind of a, you know, male profession, female profession, what does that mean? So we did, you know, kind of get into the bushes a little bit about that, you know, and talked about those issues. But what we really discussed a lot, and kind of in a way that was more frank than I've done up to now, is we talked about birthright. And, you know, I've talked to other people about birthright and why they're doing it or not doing it. And in the most cases, I've noticed that a lot of people are saying that they're not doing birthright anymore. But we didn't get into the details of why. In this episode, we got into the details. And so that's something that interests you. This is the episode for you, because she really, you know, explained clearly why, you know, even though she had committed and done so much, you know, to work for birthright, she feels now that she's just not as interested in it as she was originally. And lastly, we spoke about the future. We spoke about her future plans, her plans for study, and what she thought about, you know, the future of tourism. And also, we talked about what she's been doing in this period, and that includes making little movies and doing presentations. She's been very active with that. And so I think there's a lot to learn from this episode if you're a guide or if you're just interested. I think that this one is going to be a really special episode for you to listen to. So, all right, without much further ado, I just want to say, please subscribe to the podcast and please share this with people. I mean, you know, like I said all the time, I'm trying to create a community of listeners here. Please rate the podcast, and I'll see you on the other side.
Hello, shalom, and welcome to Tour Guide Confidential,
My name is Dr. Eyal Duchovny, and I'm here with Rotem Shachar. I'm today in a place called Moshav Pedaya. You're not so far from Tel Aviv. I came down from Haifa to spend a couple hours with Rotem here in their beautiful house out here in the fields and nature. And I'm really excited about today's conversation. Rotem has been a tour guide, I think, for something like 5 years, something like that, and has a lot of experience. We've done courses together. We've talked in the past, and so I'm pretty excited about today's interview. So welcome.
Well, thank you, Eyal, and I'm glad that you're here in Pedaya with me.
It's my pleasure. It's really my pleasure to be here, and I'm excited really to get to know more about your background. I know you have, in some ways, a similar background to me, but I'm going to give you a chance to talk about it. From what I understand, your family also is originally from Israel.
Yeah, so my mom was born on a kibbutz, a little closer to Haifa than we are now, in Kibbutz Barkai. It's near Caesarea. And my dad moved to Israel when he was 6 years old, I think, from Poland. So both of them grew up here. And I was also born here in Tel Aviv. And when I was 2 years old, my family moved to Miami, Florida.
And is that where your parents are today?
Yeah, my mom passed away in 2001, but my dad is still living there. And so I also have a brother living in Tampa, not still in Florida, but, you know, in Israel's distance away from Miami, approximately.
I see. And when did you come back to Israel? I want to hear a little bit about your background and what you've been doing all these years up to now and how you ended up as a tour guide.
Okay, so I was born in Tel Aviv. We moved to Miami when I was two. I, of course, grew up there, went to high school in Miami, and then I went to the University of Florida. So I stayed in Florida. I didn't apply to colleges too far away because I was terrified of the cold weather. And so I only applied to colleges as far north as Georgia. I applied to Georgia Tech, Emory, and UF.
What? You didn't apply to University of Georgia, my alma mater?
No. I can't apply to UF.
No dogs.
You cannot
no
apply dogs, to UF no. and UGA at the same time.
That's true.
You cannot
that's
do
true.
That.
That's a verifiable fact.
It's just like I didn't apply to FSU either. Okay, you got to choose one.
I understand.
And I actually did go to see FSU. I went to their campus. Because, you know, you tour a campus sure. before you decide to apply. And I went there and I was like, this place is atrocious. I can't live here. I'm sorry if I've offended someone.
There goes my whole FSU.
I'm sorry if I offended anyone.
Which, by the way, I guided FSU recently. So sorry, guys.
He didn't tell me that beforehand. I might not have said that.
We may have to cut this part from the... So, okay, so you went to FSU. Where did you go
no,
in the
No, I did not
you
go
went to
there.
Visit
Oh,
FSU.
I went to visit FSU, yeah.
Where did you end up?
So I ended up at the University of Florida. Okay. Because even though I got into all three, well, UF was free. Mm-hmm. I got the Bright Future Scholarship, and you just really can't compete with free tuition as opposed to out-of-state tuition. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a no-brainer. And I was undecided for 2 years as my major. Because I had no idea what I wanted to do. I don't understand how people are like, yes, and I'm going to go study anthropology. You know, I was like, how do you decide that? So I was undecided for 2 years.
By the way, anthropology is the last thing that people decide to study. We used to always joke in the anthropology department that if you like history, you study history. If you like, you know, economics, you study economics. If you like, you know, learning about, I don't know, mythology, you study classics. And if you don't know what you're interested in, you become an anthropologist. So it's really the last thing.
Right. So I was undecided for 2 years. And they said,
you could have become an anthropologist.
Yeah. And then they said, well, you have to choose a major or else you can't keep studying. So I went to chemistry. But mm-hmm. then I reached organic chemistry and I was like, screw this. That's ridiculous. And so I stopped studying chemistry. And then I had to choose something else. So I was looking at all the elective courses I'd taken, trying mm-hmm. to figure out what was my favorite elective course, and then maybe I'll find something in that sort of field. And I really liked my Intro to Soils and the Environment course. And I was like, I wonder if there's more stuff in that subject. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered that there's a major in it. I said, oh, that's pretty cool. So I decided to major in soil and water science. But by then it was going to be 5 years to get my bachelor's degree. And I was like, well, maybe I can just get a master's degree too, if I'm already here for this long. And they had a combined bachelor's and master's program. So in 6 years, you get a bachelor's and a master's degree. I was like, that's perfect. That's what was supposed to happen anyway, except, you know, I took my time figuring out what I want to do. And it was an amazing program. I really liked it.
So you completed
that,
right?
I finished it. Yeah, I got a bachelor's and a master's degree in soil and water science, and I researched. So for my master's degree, I did research on best management practices in agriculture, and I worked in two sorts of venues. One was with soil moisture sensors to figure out what the best soil moisture sensor in the specific area I was looking at is, because up until that point, farmers were going out and saying, well, we irrigated 3 days ago, so I guess we should water our fields again. It's like, well, but we can do science and tell you when to irrigate, and then you can use less water. You'll get less of your fertilizers into the groundwater aquifer. You know, this is a win-win situation for everyone and everything involved. And so I tested out soil moisture sensors. And I also tested out this thing called a spad meter, spadometer. No, it's not a speedometer. It's a spad meter.
Okay.
I still don't know what spad stands for. We couldn't find what it stands for. It's kind of ridiculous. But basically, it measures.
Named after Mr. Spad.
Yeah, but it was all capital, so it's clearly an acronym for something. But they wouldn't tell us what the acronym was.
Okay.
Like that, we looked everywhere. None of the other research papers that used it mentioned what SPAD stands for. Not their website. I couldn't get an answer from customer service. We have no idea what SPAD stands for.
What did it do? What is
so it measures how green a leaf is, which translates into how much nitrogen is in the leaf.
Okay.
And it was supposed to be a way to tell. I was testing corn crops in this instance, because we grow a lot of corn in the Gainesville area. And so it was supposed to tell me how green my corn leaf is. And if I'm above a certain number, I don't need to add any more fertilizer. So it's supposed to correlate with the amount of fertilizer that you apply to your crops. And then, you know, you save your money on, if you don't need as much fertilizer, then that's fantastic. You've saved money. And if you need more, you'll get a better yield if you add the fertilizer.
So you're in this very kind of scientific field, this very scientific framework where everything is being measured. And did you work in this field? Did you, after you got your degree, did you actually work in soil science in any way?
So the answer to that is kind of. Because after I finished, so towards the end of my degree, I was trying to figure out what in the world I'm going to do with my life. Because, you know, I didn't go in saying, yes, I need to study computer science so I can go be a programmer or whatever. I went in thinking, oh, well, this is a fun topic. Let's learn it. And then I had to figure out what I do with this. So I started volunteering for the NRCS, the National Resource and Conservation Service or something like that. And I started volunteering with them because I figured that would be a great way to see what type of work is in the field and maybe then get a foot in the door. And then I go to start applying to jobs. And then I realize that I need to choose not only a state, but a city to live in. And that was kind of overwhelming because I've lived in Florida my entire life. What do I know about living in any other state except that other states have winter?
You didn't want to go to Nebraska.
And I'm like, I don't know anything about any of these states. I know, okay, there's the Idaho potato. But what does that tell me about living in the state? Nothing. And so it just seems like a really daunting task to not only figure out what I want to do with these two degrees I have, but also figure out where I want to do it.
So how did you resolve this problem that you had?
I decided I was joining the Peace Corps.
Okay. That's a time-honored decision.
If I have to choose, like going to the Peace Corps and choosing a country seemed simpler than choosing a place to live in the United States. And I think to me it seemed simpler because I had family and still have family here in Israel. So I knew I wanted to get to the sort of Middle East region. And I was looking for something in the field of water, and I know that that's necessary in this region. So that seemed like a natural sort of place to go. And then they said, great, well, we've got positions either in Jordan or Morocco. I said, oh, that's awesome. Because, you know, I think Morocco sounds fascinating. I've never been there, but, you know, it sounds like a fascinating place to be. And Jordan's right next door to Israel, so that's also fantastic.
So did you get accepted? And
so no, I wouldn't remove all of my wisdom teeth. I was willing to remove that. You have to remove all of your wisdom teeth in order to get accepted into the Peace Corps because they're worried that if something happens, you know, with your wisdom teeth, you won't have dental services available and I was only willing to remove two of them. The two, because I had two wisdom teeth that kind of were crooked and they were like bothering me. Food would get stuck there and I've been lazy and so not taking care of it.
You're okay with getting rid of those two.
So I was okay with getting rid of those two. But the other two are fine. I really didn't see a reason to remove teeth unnecessarily. And so I didn't join the Peace Corps because I wouldn't remove my teeth.
Applying for the Peace Corps for you was like pulling teeth.
Literally.
Okay.
So if I'm already pulling teeth, let's just move to Israel.
So is that what happened at that point? That's how you decided to come to Israel?
Well, so it was actually my dad's idea. Uh-huh. I told him I was trying to join the Peace Corps, and we had a lot of conversations about it and where I would be going and what I would be doing and how in the world would I get along in a place that didn't speak English. And, you know, I mean, that's, I think, one of the things that attracted me to it was the total immersion sort of thing. I get to, you know, work with a community that needs assistance in a field that I'm working in, and I learn a new language, and, you know, it seemed like a really neat sort of program. But then my dad said, well, why are you trying to get close to Israel? Why don't you just move to Israel?
Did you speak Hebrew at that point? Did you grow up speaking Hebrew?
Yeah, my parents always spoke to my brother and I in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And I would actually speak Hebrew at home until the age of 5 when I started going to kindergarten. And then all of a sudden, all of my world took place in English. So I started speaking English at home. But my parents always spoke to us in Hebrew.
Well, that's an advantage, right?
Definitely.
When you land here. So you took your dad's advice. You decided to come to Israel. And how long have you been here now?
11 and a half years.
And what did you do when you first arrived?
I started a PhD.
You started a PhD program.
Yeah, but it's funny because, you know, I knew I didn't have the energy for a PhD. That's why I was looking for a job.
Was it in soil sciences?
In hydrology.
In hydrology. Okay. Well, this is a good place for that.
Right. So it was either go to soil and water science for a PhD in Rehovot at the Faculty of Agriculture of the Hebrew University in Hebrew, or go to the international campus of the Ben-Gurion University in Sde Boker and do hydrology in English. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I know Hebrew, but I don't think my Hebrew is good enough to get a PhD in it. And so I went with the English route. And so I didn't apply until I got here for the PhD. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, great. So I got here in January and I said, okay, so I'm going to take some time to get used to living in Israel and start in the fall. And so I send in my application and then they say, do you want to start now? I'm like, what do you mean start now? Well, the semester starts in like 3 days. I was like, you can still apply. Really? What is wrong with this place? <You know? laughs> How can I get accepted to a semester when it starts in 3 days? Uh-huh. But I did. And so I started. Yeah.
How long did you spend in the PhD program?
A year.
A year.
Okay. A year. And then I just said, I can't do this. I don't want a PhD. I mean, I kind of do want a PhD, but.
Yeah. Do you have some regret?
No.
Good, because you shouldn't have any regret about that. As someone who has a PhD, I'm telling you.
No, I don't have any regrets about it, because I know that it's something that I'm capable of doing.
Right.
So it's just a matter of, it's not an if. It's not like, can I do this? It's a, yeah, I know I can. The question is if I'm going to do it and when.
Okay, so you left the program after 1 year.
Yeah.
And then, once again, now you're in Israel, don't really have a very clear direction. What did you do at this point?
Yeah, I don't know what I did after that. I know somehow I ended up with a job. I think I just started looking for a job, and then I ended up getting a job in Petah Tikva in water science, water engineering, which basically was, I had these blueprint things of the sewage and water system of different cities, and I had to input that into the computer. Mm-hmm. I was like, why are they looking for someone with a master's degree? Take a 10-year-old, tell them it's a game, you'll get the work done as well.
Okay.
That was awful. I didn't like that.
You're in this world of science. You're in this world of, awful. You know, hydrology and soil science. How does somebody get from there
to being a tour guide?
To being a tour guide, which typically is something that people from either the humanities or the social sciences gravitate towards. So you're coming from left field here. How did you end up going into guiding?
Oh, so after I've finished doing that job I didn't like, I went through two other jobs in the sort of related fields of soil and water science and realized that this is just not what I want to be doing. And as much as I loved the research and the school, I didn't find a job that met my expectations. And so I moved in with my grandpa. in order to save money because I, you know, had no job. And then I tried to figure out what I want to do with my life. And it was in the middle of, so I do Israeli folk dancing. Mm-hmm. And I went to a folk dancing weekend in Eilat. And as a part of that weekend, there was a Jeep tour. There was a little hiking. And on my way back, I realized that's what I want to do. That's it. I want to be a tour guide. And I feel like it makes sense because when I first moved here, I would always go visit my family on the weekends. And I'd say, okay, where are we going this weekend? And they'd be like, what do you mean, where are we going? It's like, well, there's so much to see. I just got here. Let's go see something. And so in that respect, I feel like it makes sense because that's like what I took my family traveling whenever mm-hmm. I went to visit them, even though they were kind of unwilling participants. But
and where did you do the course itself?
The
where did
course you study? Itself in Tel Aviv. Uh-huh. I actually applied in Haifa University originally because I was living with my grandpa in the kibbutz near Caesarea.
Okay.
And so I applied in Haifa. But then I found a job guiding Segway tours in Jaffa. Okay. I was like, I'm not going to go Haifa, Jaffa kibbutz. That doesn't make sense. So then I transferred and reapplied in Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And that kind of put everything in one location.
Little known fact that I guided Segway tours in Haifa. I was the first one actually to, I worked for a tour operator who decided he wanted to be the first one to have Segways in Haifa.
Really?
And so I built the whole tour. We did it all wow. in Carmel and I guided those tours. But eventually so many people fell off the Segways.
It's awful.
It was awful. So many it's people ridiculous. Fell off the Segways that he was just so worried about being sued that he sold his Segways to Segs, which
but that's right, who I was
right
working for.
For, right? Yeah, he sold his Segways.
They ended up opening up a branch in Haifa, which from right. then I think shut down, or at least they moved because they're not where I remember them being.
Yeah, I don't think there is one anymore.
In they any had case, it when
it's
I was
funny,
working
I was
there,
guiding right? Segways as well, probably the same time. So what was the course like for you?
The course, oh my goodness. It was crazy.
Be honest.
It was crazy. It was intense. Studying, so the course itself was, I mean, it was really neat.
And you're not somebody who doesn't know anything about studying, right? Because you already had a master's right. going into it and had been in a PhD program for a year. And you're saying that it was intense.
It was not only that, we had two lawyers in the course with us. When we got to the exams mm-hmm. of the Ministry of Tourism, they were like, this is ridiculous. This is harder than the bar exam that they have to do here. I was like, oh my goodness. But I mean, I don't know what the pass rate was like when you did them. Right. So have you guys talked about what tourism tour guide school looks like yet?
A little bit here and there, but so, please, you know, really okay. share whatever thoughts you have.
Well, because during the course, studying for your subject specific tests was fine. I know how to do that and I do that well. But then when you have to study for the exams of the Ministry of Tourism, it's like now study everything you've learned in the past 2 years. And that's a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, especially since there's a lot to learn here in terms of the history of this place.
Right.
Which goes back, you know, to Neolithic.
Right. You know. And so you have to learn, you know, thousands of years of history. You have to learn the geology. You have to learn about the plants and the animals and minorities and Judaism and Islam and Christianity. And
plants
I'm sure,
and
yeah, I'm sure we learned more things than that, but I don't remember.
Chronologies, etc.
And that was kind of absurd. And not only that, you know, I did the course in Hebrew. I assume you did.
I did it as well in Hebrew, yeah.
And so I was like, okay, so now not only do I have to study, but I have to study in Hebrew. Right. And I took all my notes in Hebrew. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, now I have to read 2 years worth of Hebrew notes.
Oh, yeah. And I learned so many useless words in Hebrew, you know, things like, you know, bazich, whoever uses that word. But these were the type of words, you know, technical words.
Yeah,
I mean, the kind of like vase of some sort. So it was just, yeah, it was very intense.
So what ended up happening, I have a friend that we went to tour guide school together. That's how we met. But basically we would sit and study together and she would read to me. Mm-hmm. She read to me 2 years worth of notes multiple times. And that's...
Well, we were lucky because we had a friend in the course who worked at that time as a security guard for Intel.
Okay, oh, so he had a lot of time on his hands.
No.
No?
He had keys to the building. Oh. And he would bring us into Intel. And we had all the latest computers and screens and everything. And we would take these nice, you know, executive offices that the Intel executives use. And we would study there literally till like 4 a.m, you know.
Wow.
And Intel also has this like huge cafeteria where the workers in Intel could just get, you know, free, everything's free there. And so when we were hungry, we'd go down and get, you know, some Milky or, you know,
some
drinks.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And so that's where we did our study. That's what I'll remember from it. So thank you. I won't say his name in case anyone's listening. But that was a great experience. So yeah, but did you pass the first time?
So the tour guide exams in the Ministry of Tourism, there's two exams, right? There's the written exam in which it's multiple choice questions, and then you have to write out 2 days worth of a tour, basically in this table format. And then an essay, as though you're standing and talking about something. So it's funny because everyone else in my class was so worried about this written exam. What's wrong with you guys? It's a written exam. You know, that's not a problem. I was worried about the oral exam. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I passed the written exam. That wasn't a problem. But the oral exam, I was like, oh my God, now I have to guide in front of these four testers.
Testers, yeah. Three of them are tour guides and one of them is from the tourism industry.
Oh, is that how it works?
Yeah, that's how it works. they have to bring someone who's not a tour guide in as well. And it's usually someone who's a tour operator or someone who is somehow involved with the tourism industry in some capacity. And so they have four people, three of them tour guides.
Yeah, and then I was like, okay, so now there's these four people who are judging me and I have to do this all in Hebrew. And so that clearly didn't go so well. Mm-hmm. So I didn't pass that the first time around. But the second time around, I did in English.
Okay.
And that was just so much better. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it was, you know, so I don't know what the pass rate was on the days that you did your exams. I know that when I didn't pass, it was a 40% pass rate. Mm-hmm. And the day that I did pass, it was a 30% pass rate. Hmm.
Yeah. So I don't actually know the pass rates. I do know that we started with something like 40 people in our class. I think 20 went for the exam. I think 10 passed.
Wow.
You know, it was like, you know.
Each time just half.
Yeah, every time we just halved. And it was like, you know, who's the last one standing? You know, out of those 10 who passed, maybe 5 are working, you know. It was something like that. It was really, you know, many people who did it weren't even planning to work. I don't know how it was in Tel Aviv, but in Haifa, a lot of the people were retirees. They wanted to do the course. They were like, well, if I'm already doing the course, I'm going to do it so that I'll, you know, be able to guide if I want to during retirement. But they weren't as stressed about it as some of us who, you know, wanted to really make a career of this.
Yeah. So we had a really nice age range from, we had some people who had just finished the army and were after their trip and looking for, you know, direction in life and said, tour guide, that's totally it. Mm-hmm. And then all the way through retirees who exactly like you said were, you know, there for fun. And if they get a guiding license out of it, fantastic.
One of the things that our listeners wouldn't necessarily know is that while the course itself is extremely rigorous, as I said, you know, it's like 800 hours of class time. In order to get accepted to the course, all you need is a high school diploma.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite democratic in that sense, which is nice because it allows anyone this kind of opportunity. It could be, you know, the job that you do in your retirement, or it could be your first job after you've, you know, finished the army and done your big trip and come back. So it is kind of democratic, and I actually like that about it because that age range that we had in the class was actually really, I think, I don't know, it made us better guides in a way because we could really learn from each other, like, you know, what younger people are interested in and what older people, it really, I think, made us better guides.
Did you have about an equal male-female ratio? Because I remember walking into class and I was the only female there, and I was like, oh my God, what's going on?
2 years? You were the
only... Well, no, so eventually others showed up as well, but I was like really stressed out for a good few minutes until other women walked through that door.
Right. So we had women in our course, I would say about a third, definitely not a 50-50 break, which is kind of interesting. And you know, actually, this is an interesting point that I think we can discuss, which is, you know, from now that you've been a guide for a bunch of years, and you did the course and all that. I mean, what do you think about guiding as a profession for women? And also, you know, how does the fact that you're a woman, you know, how in any way does it impact, you know, the way you see guiding? Either one of those questions or both, whichever one.
So I think it's an amazing profession, regardless of gender. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it has so much to offer, and you can really bring yourself out. I think as a general statement, guiding is a good profession, period. I don't necessarily think it has to do with your gender. I think that the way society is set up today makes it more difficult for women to be tour guides when they have kids, because the childbearing, and I mean, obviously, you know, my husband can't get pregnant for me, but
not yet.
Yeah, not yet. Maybe in another few years, we'll have that figured out as well. But basically, it's still expected that the women bring up the children and take care of the house. And even though women also work in today's society.
Right.
So it's like we've gained responsibilities, but haven't started sharing any of them. And so that makes things...
This kind of you're talking about a biological thing, a biological limitation in a sense.
Well, no, only the pregnancy and giving birth thing is the limitation. Because I don't see any reason that, you know, the same way if I'm expected to go back to work after 3 months, I don't see a reason I couldn't go back to guiding after 3 months.
Right.
Except that that means that the kids would be solely my husband's responsibility. And I think that, one, he would have to, you know, be okay with that. And two, I don't know how accepted that is in today's society. Be like, what do you mean you're leaving your kids home alone with their father for a week and a half?
Well, I guess I can take this from a couple of different angles. First of all, there are people who argue that guiding is actually a great profession for women, but only if you're living like in Jerusalem, maybe, where you can be home every day at, you know, by 6 o'clock, because you don't have to take the long trips. If you're living in a place like Jerusalem, you can focus on doing these kind of day trips,
right,
and not the long ones. The other thing is, perhaps, you know, this is, you know, problem of Western society, which is that we don't live with our elders anymore, right? In other societies, it wouldn't be that your husband necessarily would have to take all the responsibility of the kids or any of it even. It would be that the elders, you know, live in the shared courtyard, as we talked about in India. The elders would be taking care of all the kids of all the brothers who happen to live around this, you know, courtyard. And then each one, the men and women, can go off and do their things. So maybe it's, you know, a Western society kind of thing.
Right. And there's also like that, my uncle has gotten into acting, and he was in a play where it was a comedy where they talk about bringing back the children's homes on a kibbutz.
Mm-hmm.
And so, right, a kibbutz was basically a socialist sort of a community where everything is shared, as is the child raising. So the children's homes are where the kids live. They didn't live at home with their parents. And so, you know, there's like a running joke through the thing that there's a mother who's trying to get the children's homes back, because that would be that would ease a huge burden on parents today. And so, I mean, I feel like that's where what you just said took me. I don't know if I had one.
Right. I mean, it is about this kind of equity issues, you know, between men and women also.
It's like it takes an entire village to raise a child.
Entire village.
And we don't live in that village.
I want to bore down a little bit more on this. I'm going to use the word tour guide confidential here to, like, mm-hmm. you know, touch on some issues. I do think that to some degree, you know, even though there are people who say that this is a great profession for women because they could come home if they're, you know, doing only day tours, we're not talking about the longer trips. And there are advantages and disadvantages to the longer trips. It depends on your personality, right? Like, I know people who work only with cruise ships and they love it. They tell me, I love working with cruise ships because I see the people just for one day and that's it. I don't have to deal with them. They start in the day. I return them to the ship in the afternoon.
See, I'm the exact opposite.
And I'm exactly the opposite as well. I mean, it's a personality thing, right? Like, I want to connect to these people.
Right. And I know that you like the buses also.
Yeah, I love the buses. I like having an audience.
I'm iffy on the buses. I go back and forth.
I like having an audience, right? I admit it. Look, that's what I'm doing, right? I like having an audience. And so I've got a bus full of people and I enjoy that experience. You know, not everyone's into that. Some people just prefer a minibus or, you know.
Yeah, so I have my Eshkol license, and the license that allows me to both drive and guide at the same time. And so I've started really doing a lot of work as a guide driver.
And you like that
work? I really like that, I think. Mm. I mean, it's also very, it's intense in a different way than guiding a bus is. Because, you know, then I'm with a family for 10 days.
And that can be complicated.
And sometimes it's absolutely amazing. Uh-huh. And sometimes it's like, oh my God, I don't know what to do with these family dynamics.
Right, because they're fighting among themselves in the bus, you know, the different generations.
And especially when I was with a family, am I allowed to talk about?
As long as you don't name them, I think it's fine. Yeah. It's up to you.
Well, because I was guiding a family, and it was four people. It was two parents and their two daughters. And they kept making fun of or like laughing at the younger one. I think she was like 15 and the older one was 17. And they kept saying that the older one was the smart one. And then I talked to the 15-year-old and I said, so what do you want to study? Because, you know, her older sister was heading to college. So, you know, there's a lot of talk of majors and things like that. She says, oh, I want to study chemistry. And she's the smart one. What do you mean you want to like that wasn't the answer I expected from someone who effectively her entire family is calling her dumb the entire trip. And she wants to study chemistry. And I mean, it went as far as that, like, everyone knew that the old one was the smart one. Even the Jeep tour driver, we were with him for, what, like an hour and a half, 2 hours? And all of a sudden, he's, like, asking the 15-year-old to read. And he's like, oh, wait, but she's the smart one. And he gives it to the other one. Mm-hmm. And, like, that was really hard for me. Mm-hmm. Just, like, that entire situation. Even just being with the family for a week, 10 days. Like, do you guys not understand what an awful psychological, like, how awful you're treating your daughter? Like, I,
you know, that's really
difficult. It was really hard.
I've had some wonderful.
I felt like, do I say something? Like at the end of the day, I'm a tour guide, you know? It's not my place to do anything about it. But that was really hard for me.
Yeah, you know, I've had some difficult experiences with families. Most part, I've actually really enjoyed it, but there have been a couple where, you know, I've had experiences where I was like, oh my God, when is this going to end? Because, you know, I have people questioning my authority, they're fighting among themselves, there's all this kind of stuff. And when it's a family, sometimes there's this power dynamic also where they're like, we hired you. Whereas when it's in a bus with 40 people, nobody feels like they're the ones who are like, telling you
what
you've
all signed up for this itinerary, right, and that's what we're going to do.
When it's like one-on-one, when it's just smaller groups, it's like, you know, we hired you. We expect you to be at our beck and call at any point. And that can be sometimes.
Right. So I haven't experienced that per se, but I think that is one of the things that I like about the family tour is that, yeah, we have an itinerary.
Right. But you can
from the feeling I've been getting from you guys for the past 3 days, Site X is really of no interest to you whatsoever. Why is it on your itinerary? And can we do something else instead?
You're more flexible, right?
Yeah, I like the flexibility of it. I like the fact that I know that this is what is written, but, you know, who cares?
Yeah, effectively. That part I really like, because oftentimes on the bus tours, I don't have any authority at all. I mean, I often joke, I tell the people on the bus, I'd be like, look, you know, I get the schedule and my job is to execute this schedule, which means I'm the executioner. And so you guys better listen to me because I am the executioner here and I need you to get through all of this today. And if we're going to do all of this, you're going to have to listen to me and we're going to go through it together. So I appreciate that aspect, but there is this sometimes, you know, some family dynamic, especially people who are wealthy enough to be able to take, you know, minibus and stay at 5-star hotels.
Yeah.
They don't understand that I'm like staying at this 2-star hotel down the road. Mm-hmm. And they're,
especially in Jerusalem.
Yeah. And they're very demanding, you know, because they expect service, you know. And so sometimes, you know, that part of it, I have a, you know, it's a personal thing. Some people doesn't bother them. But for me, it just feels like, fuck, you know, I studied to be a PhD, you know, and here I am, like, you know, running around getting stuff from the, you know, the grocery store for them because they don't, you know, they forgot something.
And I've definitely bought people toothbrushes and stuff before. I went shopping with a family trip. It was the mom or the grandma and then her
intergenerational family bar mitzvah.
And so one of her grandson's suitcase got lost. So we put basically everyone except for his mom at the Jeep tour, and I went with her, you know, clothes shopping, basically for her son, because who knows when the suitcase is going to arrive.
Right, which is part of the guiding job that, you know, you don't learn about in tour guide training.
Right, they don't teach you how to go shopping with people.
All this kind of stuff, like, you know, basically, you know,
the Israelis know.
It's not part of the Israeli culture for a variety of reasons. Unfortunately. But there's a, you know, I think there's a history behind it, but for a variety of reasons, it's not something which is really developed. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
In Israeli culture. And I think part of it also is simply because a lot of Israelis who work in the service industry are really there only temporarily, right? Like, if you talk to people who are like, I don't know what, work in the restaurant in a hotel, or even at the front desk of the hotel, most of them are studying something else, like be a lawyer or an engineer or something else. And they're doing this for now because they need to make some money. So they don't identify with the job and so they don't provide the service that you would expect of someone who's like committed. Like, I'm a hotel worker and this is my, you know, chosen career path, something that I love. It's not something that most Israelis, you know, do well. There are other reasons as well, hierarchy and all this stuff. But now that I listen to myself and talking, I want to go back to what I was going to say before, which is, I think that one of the reasons that this is, you know, in some ways, I do think it's a man's profession. I know that it shouldn't be and that gender shouldn't matter. But, you know, guys were not only because you can leave for 10 days and leave, you know, your wife with the kids, but because there's a lot of mansplaining that goes on, you know, the tour guide, right? You're getting paid to basically tell people how things are, right? I think, you know, it really appeals to men, this kind of sage on the stage, you know, kind of way of being where we can stand in front of a group and, you know, orate and tell people. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think that's funny because generally speaking, when you think typically as like a woman, you're like, ah, blah, 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 blah. I'm making those hand motions too, right? Because no one else can see me besides AL.
Right.
So that's generally when you think of who talks more, women or men.
Uh-huh.
Most people would say women for sure.
Right.
And so I think it's funny. They're like, oh, yes, mansplaining. I'm like, but no, women are typically the ones who like to talk and communicate.
Okay,
and so on that hand, you know, it's much more of a women's sort of job. If someone has to stand up and talk, that's not something you picture who's going to do that more frequently.
So you think that it's just, you know,
I think
you
it's
can
just,
go both ways.
Right, because like you said, yeah, the man can, you know, leave the woman with the kids at home. It's like, yeah, that's exactly the Western thought. Why can't the woman leave the man and the kids at home?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is that a problem?
Absolutely.
You know, I don't think that should be a problem.
So how do you see yourself as a guide? Like, I mean, when you think of yourself as a guide, what do you see your role? Do you have a kind of a philosophical way approach to guiding? How do you see yourself as a guide?
I don't know if I really understand the question. And I mean, I have an answer. I just don't know if it answers the question.
Let's hear it.
Okay. So one, I think overall, it's more about providing a sort of comprehensive experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so to a certain extent, you know, if I say that the early Muslim rule started in the year 640 instead of 638, does that really matter? Like, mm-hmm. Okay, so I've rounded a number to, you know, the closest 10 because I don't like math.
Mm-hmm.
And I get confused with numbers very easily. And so, you know, a lot of times I'll give the Crusaders, you know, a good 200 years, even though I know it's a lot more complicated than that. I say from 1099 to 1299, because that's just way easier to remember. And who cares that I've added, you know,
eight years.
Right. And so like on the one hand, does that really matter? Especially with the family groups that are coming as a family, you know, I'm not here talking to a group of archaeologists or a group of historians where I'd probably try to be a little more exact.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm here with a family who's here to overall, you know, have a nice vacation in the destination of their choice.
So what I'm hearing is that basically the experience is what really matters.
At the end of
the
day,
above the information that you're
providing. I think that the information is also important, but I think that if they come out with a positive experience and positive memories, I think that that's really the overall goal of the trip in the first place. And, you know, because they could have easily chosen to do it just about anywhere else in the world. And going just about anywhere else would have saved them a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, because Israel is not a cheap place to be. And so I think that they came here because of the importance of the place and the information that they'll be getting, but that they also want to have a positive family experience. And so especially when I do multi-generational tours, you know, I think the most important thing to me is to interact with the kids. Because if the kids are happy, everyone else is happy.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
And so to me, I think those are really the two main like my two main focal points to make sure that the kids are engaged and having a good time, or at least, you know, that I'm talking, that I make sure that I talk to the kids in addition to talking to the adults. Usually I'll start with the kids as well. And, you know.
Yeah, and that's, I think, an excellent point. One of the things about guiding that I, at least that I think about, is that, you know, often as a guide, we're kind of out there and exposed, you know, and the question is, how do you do that and still remain genuine, you know, and also true to yourself? And I have this quote that I wanted to read to you. And I'm just kind of interested to hear what you think about it. You know, your thoughts, whatever comes to mind. This is a quote from Parker Palmer's book, The Courage to Teach. And he says, "Teaching always takes place at the crossroads of the personal and the public. And if I want to teach well, I must learn to stand where those opposites intersect." What do you think about that quote?
I think it's right on target. I think, like, I think one of the reasons that I'm able to form connections with people is because I tell them about me. I tell them about my experiences at the place. I tell them about my life, you know, so they're not talking to an encyclopedia. They're talking to a human. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the times, especially if it's a family group, if we're passing through the area, like a lot of times we'll go to Beit Govrin, which is about half an hour south of us and from Jerusalem. So basically we drive right by my house to get there and to go back. Mm-hmm. So if I can fit it into the itinerary, especially if it's towards the end of the tour and I liked the group, mm-hmm. then I'll try to bring them to my house to visit, to see where I live, to see my husband, to see his workshop, because he's a woodworker, and that's always fun. We haven't talked about that yet.
Tell us, I could
do another podcast about woodworking.
Excellent. Well, I didn't know that you bring people here, but but knowing you, I suspected.
Like, that doesn't surprise you. Right?
That's why. That's why I highlighted this kind of quote, because I, you know, brought you to mind when I was.
So when I was guiding Birthright, I don't remember if it was the last group I guided or the one before, but we were supposed to go to an escape room at like 10 p.m. Wow. And then I was supposed to take them to the airport. So when was their flight? 5 a.m. And I was like, what the hell do you want me to do with them at the airport for 5 hours? And they're like, well, that's the end of the itinerary. I was like, we're not going to the airport. We're going to my place. I'm going to do a bonfire. Yeah, they gave me a budget. We didn't have to buy wood because, you know, woodworker. Yeah. But we bought them cookies and coffee and, you know, snacks. And, you know, we sat around and hung out around the bonfire. And I was like, oh my God, guys, you have to get on the bus. You have to leave now. but I feel like that was so much better than being like, and now we're going to the airport to hang out for 5 hours. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, that makes no sense. I'm glad that they let you do it, because sometimes in these larger programs, it's very difficult to get.
Right. Well, luckily, Birthright, as stringent, like, they're very strict about certain things, but they're also very open, especially with interpersonal meetings. Like when you have the Israelis that join, a lot of times you'll do something. I once took a group to one of the Israelis' house for lunch because it's something you have to arrange in advance. No, but, you know, they're very open to these types of meetings.
Every time I've done one of these things with Birthright, it's always gone through in the end. But it always involved, you know,
it's a lot of bureaucracy.
It's a lot of bureaucracy. It takes time. We had one guy in our group who was one of the Israelis. I think 2-3 days after he left the group, he fell and broke his leg and he was in the hospital.
Did you guys go visit him?
We were very close to, you know, it was here in Tel HaShomer. And I asked for permission and they gave us permission. We had the time to do it. And all of us went and visited
him. Did the hospital let you in at the same time?
We came to the hospital with a bus. They let us in.
Wow.
You know, I explained to them in the hospital as well. But, you know, to their credit, you know, it took like 2 days of Birthright discussing it among themselves and wanting it this way and not that way and all these things. But they agreed to it, to their credit. And it was a wonderful experience, right? And also, you know, the American, Americans got to see what a hospital looks like, right? And what that experience is like.
Yeah, too. And luckily they weren't admitted to the right, hospital, and they weren't admitted which is fantastic. To it, and they got I had a group where basically half of them were in the hospital at some point for dehydration. It was awful. It was my first Birthright group. Oh my God.
All right. So I want to talk about Birthright.
Okay. I've talked to Since we're talking about Birthright.
I've talked to almost everybody that I've talked to has worked with Birthright at one point or another. Some of them, you know, even 40, 50 trips.
Whoa.
Yeah. You know, oh my the first God.
I did six.
Yeah.
That was so, enough.
So if you're willing to talk about it, I know that
we've talked about
Birthright and how Birthright, I've mentioned before on this podcast, is this amazing program. I think the idea is really, you know, incredible that every Jew in the world, regardless of where you're from, deserves, it's your birthright to be able to come to Israel one time in your life at the expense of the Jewish people where everything is
coming. You know what we've effectively created?
What is that?
A Hajj.
Hajj, yeah, we do actually. Yeah, I haven't thought about that.
I mean, I just had that like epiphany that's a right now. We
that's
just
a brilliant created epiphany. A Hajj. Yeah, we basically created a Hajj, and it's an all paid, you know, all expenses paid.
All Hajj. Expense paid Hajj, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, it is in our tradition as well, right? Aliyah la'regel, right? Going up, yeah. You know. So it's something like, you know, creating a kind of a modern Hajj, and Jews from all over the world come. We have these buses with 40 people, then 40 from abroad, 8 Israelis. Usually from the military or also from universities, and then a couple other people, a guard, and you have staff as well.
What's up with the guard? What's your opinion on that?
I think the guard is, in practice, in terms of the guarding aspect, unnecessary. But because they're also a medic, that's helpful. But most of all, it just helps the parents in the countries where the kids are coming from, and I call them kids again. Where they're coming from, to feel safer about about sending their children to Israel, right? They hear that on every bus there's an armed guard. Is it entirely necessary? No, because you know we
is
do
it
tour.
At all necessary? No.
Well, like I said, maybe because first of all, they are also medics, right?
Right. No, so that's really useful. We could but they're not allowed to give them medication.
Right. They're not allowed.
Allowed to say, "Here's a Band-Aid." And they make the call, does this kid need a hospital, yes or no?
I have always been really lucky with my guards, except for one or two cases. One guy who got kicked off. Yeah, I don't really...
Did he start with a...
What he did was he liked pictures on Instagram and some of the...
That's inappropriate.
And some of the women in the group felt that it was sexual harassment.
That he liked their picture on Instagram?
He found them on Instagram and he liked their pictures. And so they came and complained that it was sexual harassment to me. And of course, I couldn't just be like, you know.
Right, you can't ignore
it. Can't
that.
Ignore it. Right. What I did was I passed it on to the operator. The operator passed it on to Birthright. And Birthright said, you know, for the sake of not creating any issues here, let's remove him.
And that's
so
shame.
Yeah. So at 3 o'clock in the morning. He went to sleep not knowing that all of this was happening in the background. 3 o'clock in the morning, the head of the guard company came with a new guard relieved him of his duty. And when everyone woke up the next day, they had a different guard. So it was a really kind of intense experience. But in all, the guards that I've had have been wonderful.
Yeah, might have been amazing.
Yeah, been really wonderful. And I've been really fortunate to get to meet them. And some of them I'm still in touch with.
Yeah, same here.
So... But I want to get back to Birthright itself. Okay. We actually met on the Birthright training course, which is a 3-week training. And it was held in Jerusalem over three successive months.
Yes.
Each month we had 1 week. And at the end it was 3 weeks. And we got a little certificate. We got even a little card, like a little plastic card.
Really?
Yeah, which says that we, you know, work for Tiglit.
I don't think I got it. Did I get a card like
that? Yeah, everyone got a card. And they also helped us, you know, find our first jobs. Because they had like a fair.
Oh, they had that fair thing.
They had a fair.
I remember that.
And then we started working as, you know, in Birthright. Some of us were already working.
Yeah, I'd already done two tours before I did the course.
We did this training. So I'd like to know, first of all, what did you think about the training? Let's start from there, from the beginning. 3 weeks training.
I mean, it was fun. I met some nice people.
People were amazing. I have to say, we had a great group.
Yeah, we had a really good group.
Yeah. And so, but in terms of the educational materials, how did you feel about that? First of all, what are they trying to teach us?
I felt like if I hadn't guided any birthright groups before, then it would have been I would have found it to be a very useful course.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like most of what they were trying to teach us, at least, I don't know. I feel like a lot of the stuff I already learned on the job or from other guides mm-hmm. while I was guiding my first two birthright groups before I did the course.
Right.
And I feel like, at least I think most of us, at least on the Kata people that were supposed to do the group dynamics with us, they were awful. I mean,
I don't know. They always show up usually within the first or second day. And some groups really connected with that. Some of them were just so exhausted that, you know, this group of like trying to do this kind of.
Inside our course itself. Like, we were supposed to sit in circles and do group discussions and we had to write things.
Oh, those guys. Yes, I remember. Yeah. So some of the.
I just felt like. Had the potential to be absolutely amazing.
That was a training on facilitation, right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I don't know.
It was how do we facilitate group discussions?
Let's say at least out of that, I felt like I got absolutely nothing out of that.
Right.
I feel like it had the potential to be amazing.
So that's one day, but it was 3 weeks.
No, but they came back multiple times.
True. Now that you mention that,
they came back multiple times.
They did come back multiple times. But in general, look, from my perspective, the course was trying to
drum. That's what I remember about it.
To drum into my head just one thing. And that one thing was, you are not a tour guide. You're a tour educator. You should not end your sentences with exclamation points. End your sentences with question marks. That was the 3 weeks of the training in a nutshell. Those two things, for me at least.
Yeah, get them asking questions. You can provide facts, but make sure that they think.
Right. So I said earlier.
Get their brains working, basically.
So I said earlier, the sage on a stage mm-hmm. kind of model, they were saying to us, no, we want a guide by the side.
Right? Yes.
And so what did you think about that, that whole training and that idea? And did that add anything to your arsenal as a tour guide?
So I think I like that. Because I feel like if people are leaving here with a very clear cut idea as to what Israel is and what Israel looks like and how things should be, they got a very one-sided tour and didn't really see things here.
Kind of a disservice.
Because Israel is so complex and rich and multifaceted and interesting that if you leave here with a very clear cut idea as to what's going on, then something went wrong.
Yeah, we didn't do our job.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so I don't know.
Our job is to confuse people.
Yes. Well, that's what I tell people in Jerusalem. They're like, you see this city wall? I know we call it the old city, but it's actually the newest version of the old city. And you know the city of David, right, where everything started? It's not in the old city. It's right outside the old city. And you see that wall over there? It's from 2,000 years ago, but the one next to it, it's only 500 years old. But then over there, you've got a little thing sticking out, and that one's 3,700 years old. Okay, so don't get confused between the time periods.
Right, exactly.
I was like, what?
They're like, wait, the old city is really a new city? But it's 2,000 years old.
Right.
That doesn't sound like a new city.
Right. And so I feel like, especially in Jerusalem, if you're not confused when you leave, we've done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's no way to not be confused by Jerusalem.
That's true. And of course, you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict, of course, which comes up because we're dealing with students who are coming from universities where this issue is, right. You know, a hot button issue.
So this brings me back to birthright. Like those people that would stage the walkouts uh-huh. and then be like all upset because we birthright doesn't provide.
What are we talking about with the walkouts?
So I don't know if it's still happening. I mean, I guess it's not still happening because birthright isn't still happening right now.
Nothing's happening.
I guess it was right. I don't know when it was. I don't know when I stopped.
It doesn't matter. But what were they doing with the?
So basically, it was what was the name of the movement? If Not Now, I think.
If Not Now, correct.
Right, and they were sending people on birthright in order to bring up the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and, you know, try to make that the focus of the tour.
Right.
And then when that didn't happen, they would get angry and stage a walk out and try to take as many people with them as possible.
They were basically kind of agent provocateurs, right? They would send people on the Birthright trip, which is a free trip. So they would come on the trip, and then they would try to turn the whole trip into a discussion on the Arab-Israeli conflict. And
showing why Israel's on the wrong side of things.
Right. And then also try to create a spectacle of some sort, a scene, which they could then record and put up on YouTube to make Birthright and Israel and the guide all look, you know, ham-fisted or flat-footed or something like that.
And so I just feel like it's ridiculous. Because, you know the agenda of Birthright going in. It's very clear on their website. They're trying to create a connection with young Jews around the world and create a connection with Israel. And we do talk about the conflict. They bring in a speaker to every group. And you know, so that is part of the tour, but it's not the entire tour. And if you want a tour that's specifically about the conflict, go on a tour that's specifically about
there's
the conflict,
plenty,
you know? Don't
these.
Go on a Birthright tour and expect that to be what you
Fact
want it to
finders,
be when you
Eintracht,
know the agenda of Birthright in advance.
Yeah, there's so many
Like, that's what makes
tours.
Me mad about it, you know? Not the fact that, like, because you can get all of that on a different tour. But if you're going, it's like, I'm going to go to a restaurant. And I know it's a Middle Eastern restaurant. And then I get really upset that they're not serving me chicken masala.
or hamburger.
Right. And then I make a scene and stage a walkout and try to take all the customers with me because they won't give me a hamburger. But a hamburger isn't a good example because sometimes they do have hamburgers, especially if they cater to little kids.
Okay.
They won't have, chicken masala.
Right.
And, like staging a walkout because of that. And, like, you saw the, I mean, today, you research a restaurant before you go. Like, you look like.
It's a totalitarian mindset in my mind, right? Everybody's got to think about this place the way that we think about it. If not, we're going to have a tantrum and take everybody that we can with us. That was an issue that was coming up a lot. I don't know if it's going to continue.
Luckily, I didn't experience it and I kind of stopped guiding. I think that was really when they started. I got a phone call from one of the tour organizers, and they had like an entire conversation as to how to handle this. And then I was like kind of nervous going into my next Birthright group.
Right.
Like, oh my God, am I going to have to deal with like some asshole that whose sole purpose on this trip? Like they've taken away a seat from someone who wants to experience what Birthright's offering. And, they're taking this away from someone who actually wants to be here.
Let me share an experience that I had. I didn't have somebody walk out. I didn't have, a big blow up or anything. I did have people on Birthright who were anti-Zionists, who were strongly opposed to Israel, but came. And that's fine because they came actually and they wanted to see and experience and learn. And I think that, for the most part, they were open. Maybe there were a couple who weren't. But I had an interesting experience, which is Birthright for a while was trying to do study abroad program. So the idea was that okay, you can come on Birthright. We'll add 2 days to your Birthright. It'll be 12 days instead of 10 days. And you'll get study abroad credits for your university.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know where that stands at the moment, if it still continues or not. But I did two of those. And the two of them were diplomacy in the Middle East, which was basically a coded word for Arab-Israeli conflict.
Obviously.
And it was at the IDC,
in Herzliya,
the Interdisciplinary Center. And there were two full days of some of the most, the best minds in political science and in history and on the conflict who came and talked to our group. And we also got to meet ambassadors from other countries. And we met Ron Prosor, who was Israel's ambassador to the UN. And we had, cocktail hour with him and, could ask him questions. It was a program that they really invested a lot of money in. In fact, partly it came out of this kind of critique where people were saying, well, you don't talk enough about the conflict. So they were like, you know what? We can do a taglit that's all about the conflict and we'll bring you the best minds that we have in Israel who can talk about it. And we met Arabs as well. So it wasn't like it was just, Israeli Jews. It was also Israeli Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
And on both occasions, on both times, they couldn't fill a bus.
What?
One time we had 23 people. the first time. The second time we had 26 people. Because most people who are coming to Israel on Birthright know what Birthright's about. So these people from If Not Now, who were like, oh, you know, making this big scene and stuff, couldn't even fill a bus on Taglit. We had 23 people. We were supposed to have 40, right? We couldn't even fill the bus. And two times I did this. So much so that in the end, they said, you know what? We're spending so much money on this program. Nobody's signing up for it. They want to join the regular Birthright to make a scene, but they're not really interested in learning about what's going on. They'd rather end up on YouTube as a sensation and get likes than actually do the heavy lifting of actually sitting in a classroom and asking questions and trying to understand it. And so for me, I feel like this group of BDS, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction, are just completely disingenuous. And that's why, you know, I look at it and I'm like, yeah, okay, fine, you know. Just nonsense.
Right.
You know. So that was my experience. But I want to come back to you. And what I want to do
back to me, okay.
Back to you. It's your turn again. And what I want to ask you is, you did 6 birthrights.
Yes. Why is that enough?
Why? And you seem pretty determined.
Yes, that's it.
That's
I'm
it.
Done.
You're done. You know, even now
when, I'm done.
Now when, you know, the economy and there's not enough, and maybe Birthright will be the only gig in town.
So there's one way I'm willing to do Birthright again.
Okay. Tell us what happened and what's the one way.
Okay, I'll start with a one way.
Okay.
Because on my second Birthright, I had the most amazing staff in the entire universe. And so the only way I'm willing to do Birthright again is if it's with those same 2 American staff people.
Okay,
they are the only ones who would be willing, who I would be willing to go back to Birthright for.
I have a staff member who I love dearly, and she's made Aliyah since then. And so I see her regularly, and we did 3 Birthrights together.
Wow.
And they were fantastic. We were like on the same wavelength, and I just, everything flowed.
And with their Birthright, I was kind of terrified of what staff I was going to get, because let's just say I didn't like the way the company worked. I only got the names of my staffers on the way to the airport to meet them. And so I never had any pre-conversations with them. I didn't know if it was I assumed there was going to be at least one guy because of the whole balance of gender thing that Birthright does.
Right.
But so basically you're never going to have an all male staff or an all female staff. You'll have representation on both sides. And so it was just the most amazing staff ever.
I take a step back and just say that most people may not realize, there's no reason they should know this, but Birthright is a big organization. And what it does is it basically farms out the tours to tour operators that are pre-approved by Taglit, by Birthright. And so I think there's something like 10 or 11 of them. And so we work for the actual tour operators, which are beholden to Taglit, but they do their own thing, and each one is different. So some of them, you know, are guides. We talk about these things. Some of them are considered better than others.
So and that, you know, when you're on Birthright, you're not the only one in charge, basically. It's you, and then you have 2 staff that come with the group, because even though they're adults, they have to be chaperoned at all times.
These are usually people who have been on Birthright before, the staff, and they meet the group already at the airport abroad, and then they, you know, begin.
They get the group think going.
Yeah, they get the group think, the hive mind. activate the hive mind. So what happened on Birthright that you decided?
Why am I done?
Yeah, so why?
At a certain point, I felt like I don't even know if they changed the rules and made them more restrictive while I was guiding, or if it just ended up feeling like
me. Rules for guides?
The babysitting rules.
Oh, the babysitting.
And by babysitting rules, I mean they're not allowed to leave the hotel once you finish the day. Like, technically, if they go outside to smoke, they violated this rule and they can get kicked off the trip. There are all sorts of rules. Like, we have to, as guides on Birthright, you have to give them set boundaries and, like, tell them what streets they're allowed to go to. Like, they're going to remember the street names you told them.
You're not allowed to take taxis.
Right.
And
they're not, they're basically not allowed to do anything alone.
Right.
And so I had a girl who started her period and she wanted to go get tampons. And, you know, like, none of us were available at that time to go with her. So I gave her some, and then we told her, buy some on your free time when we go out. And she was like, I'm not going to carry around a box of tampons on my free time. And she didn't. And then eventually, I assume she left the hotel on her own at some point in order to get a box because it was no longer an issue. And we know that she for sure did not buy any during the free time. But, you know, like, why do we even need to have that conflict?
Yeah.
Like, these are kids that are at the university. They hypothetically go out and buy their own tampons.
This is, you know, kids. I mean, the kids part are 18 to 22. That's the younger birth rate.
But even with the older ones, they're not allowed to do anything or go anywhere on their own.
The ones from 27 to 32 can go on their own. But the ones that are from 22 to 26, these people are already working.
Yeah.
Right? They're already employed. They're living on their own. Some of them, you know, maybe in long-term relationships, whatever, even married. I've had married people on birthright before. And you're telling them, you know, you can't leave the hotel and stuff. And so, yeah, it's kind of setting them up for failure. You know, because you're expecting something which isn't. On the other hand, I think in the history of birthright, which has had, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people, I think, what do they talk about? 600,000?
Yeah, 600,000 is the last big number I heard.
So I think, you know, six people have died out of the 600,000. And so they're very proud of that. Like, you know, and your kids are safe.
And I also know that a lot of them are reactionary rules. You know, because someone got in a taxi and went somewhere they weren't supposed to. And, you know, like, I think someone's like Ramallah or something. And I don't even know what ended up going on there. But, you know, so I understand that these come from real life experiences. Mm-hmm. But I feel like they're ridiculous. It's like, and you're not allowed to leave the hotel. And I know you're going to do it anyway. So I'm going to go lock myself in my room so I don't see you leaving by accident.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. You find out always on the last day when you have the final talk. And you're like, you know, talk about, you know, people, what do they call it? The rose and the thorn, you know, the fun experience that you had and the bad experience you had. And when you're doing the rose and the thorn, you know, invariably someone is like, oh, and my rose is when we snuck out of the hotel, we got drunk and went skinny dipping in the ocean, right? And that's what I'm going to remember when I go home, you know, and you're like, oh my God. And I'm so glad I didn't know any of this, you know. And it's like you're on the way to the airport, so you're not going to kick them off the program at this point. You know, what is that going to do? They'll lose $250, and for what? It's already happened. It's like, you know, it's too late. And I think Birthright knows this as well, you know, but there is this kind of like don't ask, don't tell kind of
for sure
perspective to it.
It's just, I just felt like, basically, they were saying, okay, and now you just have to babysit these fully grown adults who can function completely fine on their own, but we're not going to let them. And then we don't understand why, and the feedback that we get, they tell us that we're treating them like kids.
Yeah.
Like, what's not clear? I mean, what isn't clear? I mean, we've just taken away all of their adult privileges. Like, you're not allowed to drink. You're not allowed to do this. You can't do this. You can't go anywhere without a chaperone. No, you have to look both ways before crossing the street. And oh, we're treating them like kids, really? Like,
I'm going to tell you a story which seems unbelievable. And even when I tell it, I remember it in my head, and I think, did this really happen? Because it's just so absurd. But I remember, you know, we had some free time in Tel Aviv. We were in Sarona. We dropped off in Sarona. There's a nice market in Sarona. I went to get some bratwurst. There's this like German, you know, German kind of bratwurst place. And some of the people from the program were there as well. And they had arrived before me, and they already received their, like, you know, hot dogs. And one of them kind of looks at me and he says to me, yeah, is it okay if I put ketchup on the hot dog? And I said to him, do you like ketchup? He says, yes, I do. So that it's okay. You're not offending my people. And I thought it was so preposterous and absurd. But then I thought about it afterwards. I was like, you know, they come to this country. Like you said, they don't have any autonomy whatsoever. They don't speak the language. They're not in charge of their schedule. You know, they're always driving you crazy. They're asking you, how long is it to the next place? Because they feel like they're totally not in control of anything. Right? And so it's really kind of a short step from there to asking a silly question like, you know, is it okay to put ketchup on my hot dog? I just thought it was, you know, absurd, but that's what happened.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right.
That definitely makes sense.
We're infantilizing them on the program when we could be expecting more from them.
For sure.
But it's infantilizing, it's patronizing in some ways, if you think about it. Is that that's why you don't want to work for Birthright anymore? Or were there other things? Were there like something in particular that happened? I don't know. I'm asking.
Well, so I wasn't feeling so well when I was with one of the groups. And I was really upset because it was one of the groups that I was really looking forward to. It was a group where we were going to do a lot of bike riding. And I love bike riding. And, right. and I was really looking forward to this group. But I wasn't feeling so great. And I called them. Them would be the tour operator. And right. like, I think I need to go see a doctor. And they're like, oh, well, we have to find someone to replace you first for a few hours. Like, they're going to the hotel. From the hotel, I want to go to a doctor. No, we can't leave them without a tour guide. Right. What is going to happen to them at the hotel? You know, they have two staff members. They have a medic. And they're not allowed to leave the hotel.
They could have just sent somebody from the office to sit in the hotel lobby if they really were worried. Right. And they need a tour guide who's got, you know, tour guide training.
Right. And I'm like, what do you need a tour guide for? Literally, they don't have to do anything for the next few hours. I just need to go to a doctor and get some medicine.
Right.
And, you know.
Right.
And I mean, and then like I'm thinking about it, like later on, I was thinking about it when the tour ended. I was like, I don't know, maybe I should have asked them to replace me as a tour guide because I just, you know,
I mean,
I wasn't feeling good, and I should have probably just, you know, said, sorry guys, I don't feel good. You'll be better off with a different tour guide. But I also know how hard it is to find tour guides, especially during the summer.
Yeah.
And you know, I was like really worried that they wouldn't be able to. You know, I felt like it was an unnecessary burden to try to put on the tour operator when they're trying to facilitate, you know, 20, 30 Birthright groups at the same time in Israel in peak season where they can barely find enough tour guides as it is. And then all of a sudden tell them, guys, I'm going home, you know.
Yeah, I understand. I had an experience where I had to be replaced and it took them 24 hours to find somebody. And it was not, that tour operator no longer works with Birthright for other reasons, but I don't think they ever, you know, they never forgave me for making them have to find another tour guide, even though it was because my father was ill and I needed to go back to the States. So it wasn't like anything that I did or, you know, I had to rush back to the U.S. to, you know, be by the side of my father. But the tour operator, they never really said anything. But they never ever called me again.
Right, but you never heard from them.
I never heard from them again. And I always wondered, you know, because the people in the group loved me and I'm still in touch with them. And yet the tour operator was like, you know, oh my God, you know, he made us have to replace him in the middle of the tour. And it was not easy for them to find somebody. It took 24 hours for them to find somebody.
Even when I canceled, so after that I was supposed to have a week off and then start another Birthright. And I called those guys that I hadn't started with and said, listen, I'm sick. I'm still working. I'm not going to be healthy in order to guide your tour. You need to find someone else. Mm-hmm. It took them like almost that entire week to find someone to replace me.
In the high season, it was crazy. There was very few tour guides that weren't working.
So
I understand.
So I feel like, but telling me, no, you can't go see a doctor was just like absolutely ridiculous.
Right.
Because they don't have a tour guide to be with the group when they sit at the hotel. Like, I understand if I'm saying I need to go see a group, but we're heading to Caesarea and we need someone to guide them so I can go see a doctor. I get that you need a tour guide.
You know, but I think what you're describing in my mind is what in Israel we would call Rosh Katan, right? You know, which means a small head. Right. In the sense of like, you know, someone who's not willing to think outside of out of the lines. You know, there's someone who's like, these are the rules. You need to be with them. And don't bother me with this because now I'm going to have to find somebody or send somebody or be there myself. And sometimes, you know, like in anywhere in the world, you sometimes just need to really, like, you know, I've had this experience where on a Taglit group where I needed assistance from the office and I wasn't getting it. And so at the end, I just said, listen, I'm recording this call. And if something happens, I just want you to know that it's been recorded. And immediately they sent somebody and they helped me out with an issue that we were having. And that was the end of it. And you know what? I think they respected me for it in this case. Because I know the guy and we're still friends and it was all good. But it took that, you know. Right. So sometimes, we don't really have any options.
Yeah. And then.
But it's sad that it comes to that.
Right. And then other than that, you know, you're expected to occupy these kids as we're going to call them until, you know, 11 p.m. because you don't want them to leave the hotel. So you have to come up with programming in order to keep them entertained.
Is what a lot of people complain about.
For sure. I mean, because they don't have that downtime to just sit out, hang out, and relax with each other. Yeah. And, you know, process what they've done.
If it's not scheduled, like downtime for them to process, it's not going to happen because we're running around like crazy. And like you said, it ends 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah. And then, you know, you wake up at 6 a.m. and start all over again.
Right.
And like, so you expect me to work 18 hours,
you know,
and you're not paying me for overtime for any of those 10 days that I'm working overtime. And they're like, oh, but you get a good tip. I'm like, it's a tip. They don't have to give it, you know. And now that they have the rule, you're not allowed to collect a tip until the third day of the trip. And then, like, why? Why do my staff members have to run around and tell people, where's the money? 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 Why is this my staff members' responsibility? Mm-hmm. They could be utilizing their time so much better. And then, you know, I think I remember you talked about this with, I don't remember who, but about the bus drivers who, you know, sometimes they work for so little money that the tip is their salary, basically. So they start asking you, have they collected the tip yet? Have they collected the tip yet? Where's the tip? Where's the tip? Where's the money? And everyone's talking to me about money. And I'm like, leave me alone with the money. You know, why don't you just, instead of having the staff members run around and chasing people after money, okay, so it's not a free trip. Make it cost, how much do they give? $70? I don't remember.
No, they give, what do they give? $7? They have a deposit of $250,
right?
I think.
So
and they get
why
it back.
Don't you just take it out of their deposit?
Right.
Like,
$50 out of their
deposit. Yeah, whatever it is. Just take it out of their deposit, and you've solved this entire problem, and it just makes it a much more,
yeah,
it would make it much more of a pleasant tour.
Forced, is what they're saying. You know, then they force it. But you're right.
Okay, so write it down. Part of your deposit, well, you will get X amount of your deposit back, leaving the tip.
Or just pay us
or,
more.
You know, right.
Or just pay us more because they know that we're working these days.
Right, but forget the tip because a tip is optional. So especially now when you don't do that, you know, I'm working, I don't know how many hours overtime that is, every single day, pay me for my time.
Right.
You know, it's as simple as
that.
Well,
you know what the operators will say is we do pay an overall, they have, you know, a sum global, an overall, you know, figure.
A global fee.
A global fee, yeah, global fee, global sum, I guess.
Right.
Is what they say. We do pay the tour guide. If you check your pay stub, you get a global fee. And it's true.
Right, I got like...
You get $100.
$100
for 10 days.
Right.
You know,
$10 a day?
$10 a day for the...
It's
you
like,
know,
here, go get a Chipotle.
For the 10 extra hours that we're working, because we're working 18 hours a day.
Yeah, it's like, you could eat a Chipotle every day. Congratulations.
Oh, they don't even give you money for...
they don't give you money for meals.
Yeah.
They give you... What do they give me? 10 shekels? 20 shekels a day?
No, it was 35 shekels.
It depends on the organizer.
Oh, okay.
It depends on the organizer. I've received different amounts from different people.
And now they don't even give you money because they're afraid that you might actually, you know, bring food from home and save the money. So what they do is they give you these plastic cards. And you have to use it at certain places so that they get money for giving you the plastic cards. They get something. They get a cut from the plastic, from your use of the plastic cards that they give you.
Do they at least give more so that you can actually
No. It's always the same. It's always the same.
No, because it's never been enough to actually buy a meal.
No, it's never been enough. But now they're also making money off of you from your buying your own lunch.
So I feel like it's, you know, a lot of things that if you were to look at them as individual, If it was just the fact that they weren't giving me enough money to buy my own lunch, fine, I'll deal with it. There are certain tour operators that I work with that don't give me money for lunch at all. Mm-hmm. You know, they cover my breakfast and my dinner, but they say for lunch you're on your own. A lot of the times the group will invite you, especially if it's a family group.
Right.
A lot of places that you go to, you get free food anyway. So we're not giving you money for lunch.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, I'll deal with that. You know, I mean, I don't like it, but it's my choice whether to work with them or not at the end of the day. And because I usually like the clients and... You know, I see it as a little something I'm willing to take.
In Birthright, the name of the game is, you know, minimize your costs, right?
So, right.
So the tour operator gets something like $4,000 per participant. And if they can make the trip cost $2,500, then they've made $1,500 on each one. You know, that's not what they make. I'm just making up numbers here. But that's the way that they work. And so... They're, you know, trying to remove their expenses.
Yeah.
And the tour guide is just another line item in the expenses, right? I mean, even though we're kind of orchestrating and we're, you know, like I've said, directing this kind of big production, from the perspective of the office, we're just another expense.
Yeah. So I feel like if it were one of these things, you know, I'd be like, okay, fine, I could still do that.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that I don't get enough money to even buy a meal and I have to spend 10 days worth of meals that I need to feed myself. And the fact that I'm working 18-hour days for 10 days in a row. And the fact that I have to talk about money all the time with the bus driver and say, yes, they've collected money. No, they haven't collected money. Then I have to talk to the staff. Have you collected the money? What's going on with the money? Money, 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 money. Leave me alone with the money. And, you know, babysitting. Like, I don't want to babysit. I'm done with babysitting, you know? Like, I feel like all of these things pile together.
Right.
And then the fact that I'm so exhausted after a birthright group that I literally need between a week to 2 weeks to recover from all of this does not make it worth my while. Mm-hmm. You know,
which is sad for me because
yeah.
I know all the things that you're talking about. I've experienced them myself and deal with it. I do birthright, as I've said before, because it's kind of a calling.
Yeah.
You know, well, and I feel that
birthright is the reason that I started tour guide school. I wanted to guide birthright groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
which is even sadder to hear.
And then I find out I have to do this birthright training thing. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll do the birthright training thing. Mm-hmm. And then I've, you know, guided six groups and I'm like, well, I can't do this anymore. I can't work in the same mm-hmm. month that I guide a birthright group. It's basically mm-hmm. guide birthright, rest for 2 weeks, and then I can function mm-hmm. again. So it's not, you know, that's not worth it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So,
that's me and birthright.
We need to start wrapping up here.
Oh,
and, okay. And this is a lot of fun. We need to start wrapping up here. We've talked about this, and you just told me recently, I mean, right now, actually, that you signed up for a course to study, what is it, massage?
Massage, reflexology, and aromatherapy.
Fantastic. I can't wait till you complete. I want to be, if you need anybody to practice on, you know. That all sounds wonderful. But the sad part here is that I think you're going to study these things because of the corona situation that we're going through at the moment. And you're kind of looking at the big picture. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're looking at this big picture and you're saying, you know, I need something besides guiding because I don't know when I'm going to be able to continue guiding.
Is that a fair assessment? So right now, I don't know if everyone's gone back to work in Israel, but, you know, mostly things have kind of gone back to normal plus face masks, basically.
Right.
Is, you know, at least the feeling that I've got. Except that, you know, I'm still stuck at home because most people are still required to do quarantine when they arrive here in Israel and no one's going to come here for 10 days when they have to quarantine for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I've been really lucky that I've been able to do virtual tours so far.
Which is one of the things also I wanted to ask you, because you've been doing, I mean, like you told me last week you did.
Last week I did eight of them.
Eight virtual tours, you know, like I
that
said.
That was intense.
You basically worked 8 days a week.
Yeah, last week I worked 8 days a week, yes.
Yeah. So you have been working. It's not that you haven't been working and doing these virtual tours. Right.
So let's say that this month is the only month that I've actually made a living since Corona started.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably not going to be making a living next month, for mm-hmm. example, because, you know, so right now it's kind of the peak towards the end of summer and everyone's going stir crazy and all of the synagogues that were supposed to come had to cancel. And so everyone's really looking for something.
Programming.
Right, for programming, for something to do. And so this really came at the perfect time for a lot of these places. And now I'm trying to switch over to a monthly format with them because, one, having to go out, film a site, and edit the footage down into a 40 to 45 minute video and get ready to guide it is doable in 1 week. That's what I've been doing, but it's really intense. It's, you know, just like working the entire week and then I sleep on the next day after I've actually guided the thing live and then I start over. And
you really learned this from scratch in a sense, right?
Yeah, I made it up. I mean,
so you went,
I don't know what I'm doing.
Edited, you did all this from scratch, which is amazing.
Yeah,
actually.
Well, I mean, luckily, Oren, before he was a woodworker, he learned animation and he worked in photo editing and video editing. So I had a teacher. Mm-hmm. I mean, but for my first two or three tours, he did all the editing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went out filming together and then we would come back. We would look at the videos together, at the clips that we got. And then I would sit there and tell him what I needed. And, you know, we would sit there together and he would actually do all of the editing. So now I'm proficient enough in Adobe Premiere to be able to do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, you know.
Right.
And he also taught me how to use a tripod. And I mean, I've basically
been a big learning curve.
A lot.
You've done it.
Yeah, in order to do this. And so now it doesn't take me 4 days to edit a video. It'll take me, you know, two and a half days to put a video together. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting better, or at least more efficient at it. I don't know if I'm getting better at it, but it's becoming a more efficient process.
What are people saying about your, what kind of feedback have you been
receiving? Overall, I've been receiving very positive feedback. People are really liking it, especially that, you know, obviously doesn't replace coming to Israel. But I've been receiving very good feedback from it. So I'm pretty optimistic that I'll be able to switch to a monthly format with at least some of the synagogues that I've been working with. But again, you know, it doesn't cover the rent, you know, and as a tour guide, you know, if we're working, we're making money. We can cover our rent, our utilities, you know, it pays relatively well. And now all of a sudden, like, yes, I'm a tour guide, but I'm also a video editor and, you know, and a photographer and, and I'm also, so I've also added all of these new jobs and I'm also not paying the rent. And so it's, you know, long term, I would love to be able to continue doing these virtual tours. Is it feasible? I don't know. And so I'm also looking at other options, but I'm also looking for something that I feel like I can do and guide at the same time. And I feel like even when tourism comes back, let's say it comes back, you know, next summer, let's be really optimistic and say that next summer there's going to be tourism. It's probably not going to be the same amount that there was there was supposed to be this summer or that there was last summer. And so even then, okay, great. The skies are open. We have a vaccine and people are coming back, but in what numbers? And that's really the question. Because if you say, yes, tourism's back, we've had a whole three groups this summer, that's not really tourism. You know, that's one guide who has a job.
It's not even a question only of, you know, whether there'll be a vaccine and stuff. The problem is
financially.
Yeah, exactly.
Will people be able to? You know, a lot of people have been furloughed. A lot of people have been fired, you know, just because they had the money to do it this summer or last summer doesn't mean they're going to have it once the skies are open.
Yeah, of course, you know, because tourism, travel, especially long distance travel, that is...
It's a luxury.
A luxury item, exactly.
And that's the first thing to go.
Right.
And so to me, I think reasonably, I'm talking about when I say tourism, I mean what I was supposed to have this summer, what I had last summer. That's not going to happen this coming, you know, 2021. I don't really, I mean, I wish, but I can't imagine it being as busy. So for me, you know, 2022 is really my optimistic deadline.
How long is your study program? When are you starting?
So it starts in November. It's a year. And so I feel like that really covers me for the next year. At least it gives me something to do, even if I'm not making money. At least I'll be occupied.
Right.
Which will be good, I think.
Any government support to be able to do this?
So they have this voucher program.
Yeah, the voucher program.
And I called the, how do you say Lishkata Tasuka in English? Employment ministry?
Yeah.
Or something like that?
Yeah, the employment ministry.
Right, and they said, oh yes, you have to talk to your personal employment coach or whatever they called it. My person that I'm supposed to talk to there.
And what did your person say?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been able to contact them yet because they work from noon to 3 p.m. or something, Mondays through Thursdays. And I'm like, well, I'm glad they work every day. But, you know, I wish they'd work slightly more reasonable hours. And so I've tried calling a few times, but I've never gotten an answer. So I don't know. So as of right now, I have no idea if I'm going to get government assistance to do this. But really, you know, because people here talk a lot about getting unemployment benefits and then extending them until forever. And I feel like that's helpful. It's like, but it's like you can either bring a man a fish or you can teach him to fish. So I feel like that's bringing a man a fish. You know, I want to be taught to fish. I don't want someone to give it to me. I want to do it myself.
Well, it looks like you're doing that. You found something that you're interested in. You found a program which is 1 year. The question is, are you going to continue guiding after that?
Well, I hope so, because I think that massage, aromatherapy, reflexology is something that, in a certain way, I can, especially if I go into the private sector, I can kind of take groups and take clients, you know, intersperse them. You know, if I know I'm going out with a group for a week, I don't book clients in that week. I say, I'm not going to be here. I'm sorry. We can do the week after, or, you know, we can do on a on Sunday and Friday, and that's kind of like two different weeks almost. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of wiggle room in this field. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like this sort of, like the field of holistic healing as a general statement is not as variable and flexible as being a tour guide, but I feel like the schedules could work together somehow. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of
I think you'd be great at it, at all of those things, and especially in wellness. And I really wish you well with it. Honestly, I'm excited to hear how your program goes. You know, we'll be in touch and I want to hear how it is. And wanted to ask if you had any final thoughts you wanted to share. Yeah, first of all,
having fun. That makes me sad.
I know. We'll have you back again in the future. Is there a website maybe that you want to share with people?
Rotemguide.com. ROTEMGUIDE.com.
And if people want to see any of your tours, is everything listed on the website? Like the ones you're doing now, these virtual tours?
The ones that you can sign up for are listed on the website.
Okay.
The ones that you can't sign up for aren't.
Okay. Those are through the synagogue.
Right. Okay. So I'm thinking maybe at some point I'll just start doing virtual tours that are open to whoever wants to sign up. Mm-hmm. That's just really stressful for me because, you know, I don't know who's going to sign up. I don't know how many people are going to sign up. It's like saying, it's like saying, I'm going to give a tour and hope that someone comes. And I mean, I used to do free tours with the Sandman's people in Jaffa. And I didn't like it. Because, you know, I didn't like that. One, the uncertainty of how many people are going to show up. Because, if you have at least 5 people that show up, you have to guide the tour. And they're like, okay, so I'm basically guiding a tour for free. Because 5 people are not going to give you the same salary that 15, 20 people are going to give you. It's like, okay, so I got a free meal out of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's like kind of disappointing at the end of the day, especially when this is supposed to be my living.
Yeah, but the good thing about doing these online ones is you can get a sense about, you know, 4 or 5 days before how many people have already signed up. And if there's not enough, you can, you know, put a caveat in there that, you know, you need to have a certain number of people for this to proceed. And the other thing that you can do is you can do a online virtual tour. And even if there's only one person who signs up for it, you can then maybe put it on a page where people pay to see the video.
Right. So I'm working on that sort of thing. That's like my goal with my website. That's kind of what I want to be there. I want to have virtual tours that I record myself guiding and then insert it into a little square in the video. And then you can see me guiding at the site and it just won't be live. Mm-hmm. And then you pay per view I haven't figured that out yet because I know sometimes, you know, internet's iffy and maybe you have to stop in the middle and. So I don't know exactly how to work that and then figure out how much to charge. I don't know because most people that I know, even for the live ones, it's on a donation basis. I'm like, you know, that's one of the reasons I didn't like Sandman's. I didn't know how many people were going to show up and I didn't know how much I was going to get.
You can't plan ahead for the future because you don't know what you're going to be earning.
Right. Yeah. So I'll be like, okay, great. So everyone loved it and I earned 50 shekels. Like I had, you know, 50 people, each person gave me a shekel and I'm like, great. So what did I do with it? I didn't even buy a meal at a restaurant with that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so if I can't get a meal at a restaurant, how am I supposed to pay rent with it? So that's really my main fear, I guess, with opening it up to the general public. And I think that's why I haven't really done that yet. Mm-hmm. And that's why I've been focusing most of my energy on finding synagogues to work with, JCCs, people that I know that can say, yes, I'm going to give you this sum of money in order to guide this tour. So,
well, I hope things, business picks up. And I think it's great that you're going to be studying. And hopefully by next summer, like you said, maybe we'll start seeing.
Maybe there will be tourists again.
There'll be some tourists.
And, oh my God, people, thank you. Yeah, I'm so happy you're here. Exactly. Are you real?
Yeah.
Poke? Oh my God, it's a human.
It's so much better than the virtual of it. I hope to see you when I'm guiding in different places and run into you as we do. All right. Well, thank you for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. everyone who's listening, please check out her website. Hopefully there'll be some tours for the general public soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Wasn't that lovely? Yeah, that was a great talk with Rotem. I want to really thank her for her hospitality at her home in Moshav Bedeya, and to her husband, Oren. I had a really wonderful time there, and a absolutely delicious kale salad, as well as some really good tea. It's always nice to find somebody who has a tea passion, such as myself. I'm not going to get into the episode. I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this is really the longest episode, so I'm going to just say that our next episode is also a great one. It's with Naomi Ehrlich Cooperman, and I went to her home in Jerusalem, sat down with her, and really just wanted to learn and hear from her about her experience as a guide over the past 40 years. Actually, this is one of my goals also as part of doing this podcast, is to kind of create an oral history of the guiding profession in Israel and the changes that have happened to tourism over that time. And Naomi certainly didn't disappoint. She shared her experience of 40 years and also her secret of surviving during these downturns, such as what we've got at the moment. Another reason I wanted to sit down with Naomi was because she's on the board of Moreshet Derech. Moreshet Derech, I've mentioned before in this podcast, it's the Israeli Tour Guide Association organization for incoming tourism. It's the ITGA, Incoming Tour Guide Association. And she told me a little bit about kind of the politics that goes on behind the scenes and the need for organizations such as Moreshet, especially during periods such as this. Okay, and the last two things that I wanted to mention are, first of all, that on October 1st, I'm going to be doing another lecture in my three-part series about India and Israel and the connection between Hinduism and Judaism, what I called Hinduism, Judaism, shared roots, different branches. I had one lecture about 6 weeks ago or so, and this is the second of a three-part series. So please check out the website at tourguideconfidential.com. And there under events, you'll see the information on exactly how you can join this lecture. It's going to be by Zoom, and so all the details will be there. This Friday, we're going to be celebrating the Jewish New Year, what's known as Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah in English. And it's the year 5781 in the Jewish calendar. And usually, you know, even though it's not as a joyous or, you know, event like New Year's in the Christian calendar, it is usually a joyous event where we have apples dipped in honey and we talk about it being a sweet year. But after this past year, which has, you know, kind of been rough on everybody, I think that the proper greeting and blessing for the coming year is Tikle Shana Vekilotea, Techel Shana Ubirchotea, which means may we put behind us the year and its curses and look forward to a year which will begin with blessings. So to everyone out there, I wish you a happy new year, and I will see you in the next episode.